ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, former Channel 7 producer Taylor Auerbach faces a barrage of tough questions in the Bruce Lehman defamation case. Also, after the death of Australian aid worker Zomi Frankum, the Prime Minister flatly rejects Israel's claim these things happen in war. And in Alice Springs, youth workers say their nighttime patrols are proving crucial during the evening lockdown.
In the curfew, their role is very much focused on engaging with young people in the CBD high-risk area and making sure they've got a safe place to go and taking them back there.
First tonight to the Bruce Lehman defamation case. This afternoon, the Federal Court in Sydney has heard allegations the Seven Network reimbursed Mr. Lehman for money spent on drugs and sex workers as it negotiated an exclusive interview with him. The claims are being made by former Seven producer Taylor Auerbach. Mr. Lehman, a former Liberal staffer, sued Network 10 and journalist Lisa Wilkinson after they aired an interview in which his former colleague Brittany Higgins alleged she'd been raped in Parliament House. Mr. Lehman has consistently denied any wrongdoing and no findings have been made against him. Our reporter Patrick Bell is following the case. Patrick, what's Taylor Auerbach told the court today?
Well, there are a number of lines of questioning that Taylor Auerbach provided answers to this afternoon. But perhaps most critically, he has repeated and stood by his claim that the Seven Network reimbursed Bruce Lehman for money he spent on illicit drugs and to engage sex workers over a two-night period in January 2023, while Channel 7 were trying to persuade him to give an interview, an exclusive interview to the Spotlight program. Taylor Auerbach told the court that Bruce Lehman paid initially for the alleged engagement of sex workers and purchase of illicit drugs, but then later that month, after returning to Tasmania, where he was at the time, he had said that his bank account was dry and asked if Seven could pay a per diems invoice, effectively a daily allowance for that period that he was in Sydney. And Taylor Auerbach told the court that that invoice was issued, and Bruce Lehman later told him that the money had been received, and so he stood by that claim. He also stood by claims that he was instructed to delete his communications with Bruce Lehman by both the network's external lawyers and the executive producer of the Spotlight program. However, one detail that has emerged in court that has taken on a slightly different form is relating to the claim that the network had paid for Thai massages that Bruce Lehman received on a night in November 2022. It's important to note Bruce Lehman has denied receiving a massage at that time, but the court heard today that Taylor Auerbach charged that to a Seven corporate credit card, and the next morning offered his resignation and said, with profound regret and immense remorse, that he had offered his resignation for having used the corporate credit card for something that had nothing to do with work.
Taylor Auerbach, I know, got quite a grilling from the barrister for Bruce Lehman this afternoon. How did he seek to discredit him?
Matthew Richardson sought to establish that Taylor Auerbach had been motivated to try and humiliate the network and destroy anyone who was either involved or connected to Channel 7. He put various times to Taylor Auerbach that in the process of developing the Spotlight program, he had become a smaller and smaller part of the production team and had been isolated or excluded from a lot of the work there, and that that was a motivation for the actions that Taylor Auerbach is taking. He has replied and said that's not his reason for testifying to the court in this manner. He was also questioned about his alcohol consumption over the period of late 2022. Matthew Richardson put to him that on some occasions he was drinking up to 20 standard drinks a day, and that his recollection of anything in that period was suspect or unreliable. Taylor Auerbach disagreed and said that and also disagreed with a proposition put by Mr. Richardson that Bruce Lehman was not the source of some of the material that Channel 7 obtained from the electronic brief of evidence in his criminal case. He stood by the claim that Mr. Lehman provided some of that material, including an AFP statement of facts.
So, Patrick, Justice Michael Lee now has to work out how this fresh evidence fits into the case and whether it affects his judgment, which we know he'd already written. He was hoping to be able to deliver his judgment next week. Do you think that's still looking likely?
Late today, just before the court adjourned, Justice Lee said that there were a number of new pieces of evidence and text message exchanges and all sorts of things that had gone into the file today that weren't in there this morning. And he said he's going to have to look at those, and that's a more substantial exercise than first thought. And so perhaps his timeline initially of trying to deliver a judgment next week may be pushed back. I expect we will get some more clarification on that tomorrow.
Our reporter Patrick Bell. Pressure is growing on Israel to conduct a full and transparent investigation into the killings of seven aid workers by an airstrike. Some lawyers and aid agencies are calling for an international investigation rather than a probe conducted by Israel alone. And as governments wait for more information from Israel, humanitarian organisations are reassessing the security situation in Gaza and how safe it is for them to continue their work. This report from Alexandra Humphreys.
The bodies of foreign aid workers killed by Israel in an airstrike in Gaza, including Australian Zomi Francom, have now been taken to Egypt. The body of a Palestinian man killed in the attack has been buried at his home. Israel has accepted responsibility but claims their deaths were an unintentional mistake. An inquiry is underway. Avi Hyman is an Israeli government spokesman.
Well, we've done a preliminary investigation and the preliminary findings show that it was a tragic mistake. I mean, obviously we know that this isn't something that the IDF would do or the Israeli Air Force would do on purpose.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese isn't satisfied with Israel's explanation, agreeing with Spain's Prime Minister that it's insufficient and unacceptable.
For them to lose their life in these circumstances is outrageous and completely unacceptable. Humanitarian workers are protected under international law, and the Netanyahu government must publish a full and transparent investigation, and they must be held accountable. One of the things that Israel says is that it is protecting people's lives, innocent people. Well, this stands in stark contrast.
Some senior coalition figures haven't been as forthright. Liberal Senator Simon Birmingham was asked about Israel's explanation.
Well, certainly tragedies do happen in war and mistakes do happen in war, but it's also important to understand the deep, deep concern and distress that is felt in Australia, the compassion for all of the families involved, of all seven workers, it's only, of course, the Australian, but all of those and all of the other lives lost.
Celebrity chef Jose Andres is the founder of World Central Kitchen. He claims the Israeli attack targeted the aid workers systematically, car by car.
But what I know is that we were targeted deliberately, non-stop, until everybody was dead in this convoy. That cannot be the role of an army. That cannot be the role of an army that has hundreds of drones above Gaza in any single moment.
He's called for impartial investigations.
We need to have an investigation that is neutral and is above IDF.
The former chief executive of World Central Kitchen, Nate Mook, points out the tragedy has had a detrimental effect on the delivery of aid in Gaza as famine closes in.
Clearly now with World Central Kitchen no longer up in Gaza, ANERA, another NGO that is operating in Gaza for decades, is no longer operating in Gaza. Another NGO, GEM, Global Empowerment Mission, has said that it is reconsidering its operations. And so this is going to have a catastrophic impact to an already terrible situation for the civilians on the ground.
Humanitarian group International Rescue Committee says Gaza is the most lethal place in the world to be an aid worker. Nearly 200 have been killed since October. The United Nations has suspended nighttime movements in Gaza to increase safety. Dr. Fozia Alvi is a Canadian doctor born in Afghanistan and founder of the charity Humanity Auxilium. She visited Gaza in February and saw firsthand the impact the conflict is having on the children.
Everywhere we have seen, outpatient settings or inside the hospital, severe levels of malnutrition, children's dying of starvation, serious shortages of food, fuel, and medical supplies.
Dr. Alvi described seeing children with crush injuries, burns, and sniper shot injuries. Others are suffering the impacts of malnutrition.
Lots of children have lost their eyes when their school was bombed. We saw a brother and sister that brother lost his eye and he suffered complex fractures. And he was studying in the UNRWA school with his sister. And his sister had multiple fractures and the shrapnel went into the chest cavity. And she had to undergo lots of surgeries. While we were there in Gaza, we were literally seeing signs of severe malnutrition. We saw small children with severe vitamin D deficiency, literally their softening of the skulls and the bowed legs, skin and bone patients.
According to Save the Children, more than 2% of Gaza's child population has been killed or injured in the past 6 months.
Alexandra Humphreys reporting. Well, as we just heard in that story, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has called the deaths of Zomi Francom and her colleagues outrageous, and he's demanding accountability from Israel. For his analysis of the political ramifications of this tragedy, I spoke to David Spears, the ABC's national political lead and the host of the Insiders program. David, do you think the death of Zomi Francom and her World Central Kitchen colleagues is altering the Australian government's stance on the war in Gaza?
I do, Sam, think we are seeing a harder line from the Albanese government towards Israel. It has for some months been gradually hardening. The position has most recently been a call for a sustainable ceasefire along with the release of the hostages being held by Hamas. But this week, after this airstrike on the aid convoy in Gaza, you've seen open expressions of anger. Repeatedly, the Prime Minister has been talking about his outrage and demanding answers, and today taking real issue with one of the lines from Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, that this happens in war. That is not an excuse, Anthony Albanese says. This fog of war argument won't wash with him. This, he argues, was a breach of humanitarian law. So yes, we are seeing a much harder line from the Australian Prime Minister.
There's a lot of discussion and speculation at the moment about what form Israel's investigation into this tragedy will take. What action can Australia take to get Israel to investigate the matter thoroughly and perhaps change the way it's conducting this war?
Well, so far, the action has only been to demand and demand repeatedly that this be a thorough, independent, transparent investigation. Beyond that, the Australian government is not being too specific. It's basically put the ball in Israel's court. It's waiting to hear back on exactly how this investigation will take place. If it is unsatisfied with whatever Israel decides to do here, if it doesn't believe it is sufficiently independent or robust, then perhaps it will take some further action or make further demands. But at the moment, the ball is in Israel's court. There have been various suggestions. Reverend Tim Costello, a well-known humanitarian aid leader in Australia, has said it should be an international investigation and the Australian Federal Police should take part in that. The government's not going that far yet. As I say, it's waiting to see what Israel announces.
David, do you think there are risks for the Prime Minister here at home if he ramps up his condemnation of Israel?
Look, I think the Prime Minister has been cautious over the past 6 months or nearly 6 months since this began to avoid fanning anti-Semitism in Australia. He's repeatedly said we need to maintain social cohesion. And while he is still saying that this week. Clearly, some of that caution has dropped after this airstrike on the aid convoy, and he is more willing to be more aggressive towards Israel. So that always carries a risk, but I think in the circumstances, the Prime Minister believes it's warranted.
And how do you see the Prime Minister's approach contrasting with that of the opposition?
We've seen really from the outset quite a political divide in Australia over the approach to this war. The coalition has been far more sympathetic towards Israel, and that certainly has been the case this week. We haven't seen Peter Dutton being willing to criticise Israel. And even after this airstrike, there's been an echo, if you like, from many senior Liberal and National Party figures of what Benjamin Netanyahu has said, that mistakes happen in war. Nor are we seeing these expressions of anger or outrage from the coalition. They say judgment should be withheld until the investigation is complete. So yes, quite a different tone, quite a different position from the opposition.
Do you think those beliefs are genuinely held, or is this a case of the opposition perhaps not seeing any electoral advantage in condemning Israel's conduct?
Well, with politicians, whatever they're saying, there's always an element of politics in it. But I do think for many in the coalition, they've long held very supportive, strongly supportive views when it comes to Israel. So it's no surprise that we're seeing that come through now.
David Spears is the ABC's national political lead and the host of Insiders. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, new building approvals are down. So what will that mean for housing affordability in the years to come?
Building approvals fell again in February, and that's after a few months in a row of falls. So right now, we're not looking in good shape.
After months of unrest and crime sprees in Alice Springs, many residents say a snap youth curfew is transforming life in the central Australian town, and police are noting a significant drop in offending. But with less than a week to go until the temporary restrictions are set to end, some locals are concerned the violence will soon return. This report from Gavin Coote.
As the sun disappears over the West Macdonnell Ranges, the streets of Alice Springs are noticeably quieter than usual. Dozens of police are patrolling the CBD and forcing a curfew on people under the age of 18 between 6pm and 6am. Working alongside them is a team of youth engagement staff from the Territory Families Department, overseen by Brendan Boyce.
In the curfew, their role is very much focused on engaging with young people in the CBD high-risk area and making sure they've got a safe place to go and taking them back there.
The emergency measure was taken last week in response to escalating crime and antisocial behaviour. Since it began, police and youth engagement officers have spoken with more than 300 young people in the CBD during curfew hours. Most of them have either agreed to leave the area or accepted a ride home. With the curfew now in its second week, Brendan Boyce acknowledges not everyone's aware it's in place.
What we've found since then is that if young people are from Alice Springs and live here, they do now know about the curfew and what it's about. Interestingly, if there's young people that are visiting, maybe from community or from even interstate, we're still finding that we need to do that education piece and let people know about the curfew. We've definitely noticed a significant reduction in the number of young people in the CBD high-risk area. And we've also started to notice, you know, a small reduction in just the general issues that we usually might face across the town itself.
At a local pub, Arunda Amudjara man Geoffrey Miller reckons the curfew's made the CBD much safer at night.
It's working. But what's happened since they've started it, it's pushed it out. The police are coming around the town instead of going to the suburbs because you're more stuff happening out there because they know. They should extend it because it's keeping... Now tourists can feel safe walking around our central district, where before no one leave their rooms.
An extra 60 police have been sent to Alice Springs to help enforce the measure, and despite the surge, no arrests have been made. Acting Senior Sergeant Lee Yates denies the curfew has moved the problem to other parts of town.
There hasn't been a flow-on effect that we've noticed at this stage. So it's not like the curfew high-risk areas pushed out the youth crime or the trouble. There's always going to be trouble regardless of curfew conditions and where you are. But what we're not seeing is the curfew-imposed conditions not pushing out the youth or other trouble to those other surrounding areas.
Scott McConnell is an independent consultant and former member of the NT Parliament who's based in Alice Springs. He worries the laser focus on the curfew could distract from the deeper challenges around education, housing and alcohol.
What's happening at the moment, these terrible circumstances that are happening in Alice Springs at the moment, we do need to understand that the biggest thing that's driving them to happen is actually implementation of government policy.
And there are, of course, different views about the curfew itself, but has it perhaps given the town, I guess, a bit of breathing space to maybe find common ground here at the moment?
Yeah, look, I would absolutely agree with that. So the vast majority of people that I'm talking to, regardless of their background, the people that I'm talking to that care about this place absolutely accept that the curfew for a short period of time was needed. But we've just got to be a little bit mindful that there's a lot more work to do here. And I'm concerned for the young people of our town, particularly the Indigenous First Nations young people of our town, that at the moment, because the curfew is focused on them, a lot of the conversation has been focused on them. Remember, we have an issue with adults behaving in a way that's not good for society, drunk and sober. We have a massive problem within the community around domestic violence, and all of these things are playing in as well.
The curfew is set to run until next Wednesday. The Northern Territory Government is considering whether to extend it, potentially until the end of the school holidays the following Sunday.
That report from Gavin Coote and Jano Gibson in Alice Springs. New figures suggest Australia's housing crisis could deepen further because fewer properties are being built. Official figures show building approvals fell by nearly 2% in February. A shortage of skilled workers and challenging business conditions are also hampering the construction of new homes. So, with Australia's demand for housing already well ahead of supply, what does this trend mean for housing affordability in the coming years? Here's our business reporter, David Taylor.
The building industry is facing a long list of problems when breaking ground on new homes. Alex Waldron is a director of Master Builders Australia.
Yeah, we're facing, you know, difficult circumstances.
Those circumstances include builders who have fixed price contracts with their clients, struggling to make ends meet in a high inflation world. In addition, she says, a shortage of skilled labour, higher interest rates and regulatory challenges have all made building homes harder.
Look, the number one challenge for the industry is the workforce side of things and attracting, you know, more workers into the industry. We've got a sort of a chronic shortage of workers in the industry. We've talked about 90,000 people needed in 90 days. So, you know, there's big challenges there, and that's the number one issue we hear from our membership.
Builders' frustrations have been backed up by the latest Bureau of Statistics data on building approvals. The total number of dwellings approved, including the number of large apartment projects, fell 1.9%. AMP's head of investment strategy, Shane Oliver, says it means supply of housing is now falling even further behind demand.
Well, unfortunately, the building approvals data tells us the exact opposite of what we want to see.
In August last year, the National Cabinet agreed to an ambitious new target to build 1.2 million new well-located homes over 5 years from July 1 this year. It means building roughly 240,000 dwellings every year. The Bureau's data shows at the moment just over 170,000 new homes are being built per year. Shane Oliver says, based on today's building approvals data, that number is falling, not rising.
Building approvals fell again in February, and that's after a few months in a row of falls. They're well down from their highs. In fact, the level of building approvals and I know that monthly data can bounce around a bit, it's consistent with something like 150,000 dwellings being built per annum. So right now, we're not looking in good shape to meet that objective to build 240,000 dwellings per annum.
PM asked Housing Minister Julie Collins' office how the government was going to achieve its housing construction goals, given building approvals are falling. We were directed to comments she made earlier today after opening a new social and affordable housing complex in Sydney.
Since we've come to office now, we've invested over $25 billion in new housing investments. Here, what we're talking about is collaboration between tiers of government, the private sector and the community sector. What we have are social homes, affordable rental homes and private homes in mixed tenure buildings. This is what the new housing of Australia should look like. This is what we want to see more of.
Master Builders Alex Waldron.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, there's a bit of commentary around, you know, the ambitions there and how achievable delivering on that front is.
Is it achievable?
It's a big challenge, you know. We can't say that now. With these existing constraints, you know, ones that are, you know, global market constraints and economic constraints, it's tricky to see whether we're going to be able to cut through and meet those targets.
AMP's Shane Oliver notes that upwards pressure on property prices will continue if demand continues to overwhelm supply.
David Taylor reporting. In Taiwan, residents are dealing with the aftermath of the most powerful earthquake to hit the island in a quarter of a century. At least 9 people have been killed and more than 1,000 injured. Dozens are still missing. Rescuers and excavation crews are working around the clock, removing debris in the city of Hualien, close to the quake's epicentre. This report from Rima Chia.
Excavators are hard at work in the city of Hualien, removing slabs of concrete fallen from damaged residential apartments and offices. Many buildings in the city centre have been completely levelled. Others are teetering on angles at risk of collapsing. West Australia MP and member for the federal seat of Hasluck, Tanya Lawrence, was staying in Hualien County near the epicentre when the earthquake occurred.
My husband and I just decided to take a short Easter break to Taiwan just to, this place has got extraordinary beautiful mountains and gorges. There was just this most extraordinary noise and it sounded like distant rolling thunder that was just getting louder and louder and then was just coming up through the earth and you just feel it through your body. The hotel room was so violently shaking from left to right, we could not stand on our feet.
Tanya Lawrence and her husband were able to escape unharmed, but they still can't leave. Rescue crews face the mammoth task of clearing mountainous roads blocked by landslides and buildings. Fire authorities say they've already evacuated some 70 people trapped in tunnels near Hualien City. Deputy Director of the city's fire department is Li Longshen. He says the challenge ahead will be freeing people from precarious situations.
If we look at the structure of the building, its ground floor and second floor were squeezed and distorted, so the weight of the upper part of the building pressed on the trapped resident. This is the most difficult part.
Authorities are using drones and helicopters to look for people in the gorge and will drop supplies to them when they are found. They initially lost contact with 50 hotel employees in minibuses in the Taroko National Park after the quake downed phone networks. Around a dozen of those employees have been located now, with 38 still listed as missing. Although Taiwanese people are used to earthquakes, the sheer power of this one caught them off guard. This TV anchorwoman was broadcasting live moments before the 7.4 magnitude earthquake struck. Taipei local and author Clarissa Wei says there were serious issues with the warning system in place to alert locals.
It's usually only a couple seconds or maybe up to a minute before the phone blares and it says there's an earthquake happening. I personally didn't get it. So there are people who are frustrated that alarm wasn't activated, especially for an earthquake as serious as this. I've been living in Taiwan full time since 2020, and this was the most serious earthquake that I have been in.
But she says overall, Taiwan should be proud of how quickly and effectively authorities responded. Adam Pascale, chief scientist at the Seismology Research Centre in Melbourne, says Taiwan thought ahead to minimise damage in future disasters.
The government really did enforce new building standards and encouraged older buildings to be retrofitted to be more earthquake resistant. There's a lot of, obviously, buildings that were built before those standards, which basically means there's less reinforcement on those lower levels to keep them more open for, say, retail or whatever, and that makes them a little bit weaker. So I think part of that re-engineering is to strengthen those lower floors of some of the older buildings.
The search for those missing and the extensive cleanup continues.
That report from Rima Chia. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. If you'd like to listen back to any of our interviews or reports, you'll find them on the PM webpage. And you can tune into the program live or later on the ABC Listen app. That's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Israel says it was a mistake, but how does a military manage to bomb a clearly marked aid convoy? Today, a longtime aid worker, Tim Costello, on why no one trying to deliver aid in Gaza is safe and what the world should do about it. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.